The World and Everything in It is brought to you by listeners like us. My name is Amanda Jarvis, and I am a stay-at-home mom in Spokane, Washington State. I'm currently enrolled in the World Journalism Institute mid-career course, where I am informed, educated, and inspired by Marvin and Susan Alasky and my fellow classmates. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. A recent court ruling in the UK is offering hope to parents fighting transgender treatment for children.
It's a very alluring concept to believe that any discomfort you have in your body can be fixed with surgery and drugs.
Also, Open Doors releases its annual list of countries where it's hardest to be a Christian. Plus, we'll meet a violinist who lost her livelihood during pandemic shutdowns, but found her calling.
I think it's really important to have a good relationship with a teacher, then it will like spark.
It's Thursday, January 14th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown.
Now the news with Kent Covington.
The House of Representatives has impeached President Trump for a second time.
Article 1, incitement of insurrection.
That charge stemming from last week's deadly mob siege of the Capitol, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi read the final tally.
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Many Republicans, like House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, did not defend President Trump.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding.
But McCarthy and most other GOP members argued that impeaching Trump again a week before he leaves office would only further divide the country. However, it was not a straight party line vote. 10 Republicans crossed the aisle voting yes, including the number 3 GOP House leader, Liz Cheney. She said Trump, quote, assembled the mob and lit the flame of this attack. And she added everything that followed was his doing. If a 2/3 majority in the Senate convicts Trump, it could then bar him from ever running again. But a Senate trial will not take place until after President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in on Wednesday. Another online platform is locking the president's account. World's Paul Butler reports.
YouTube has suspended President Trump's channel for at least a week. The Google-owned platform said it's freezing the account due to, quote, ongoing potential for violence. And the company has said it removed uploaded content to Trump's channel on January 12th for inciting violence. It did not provide any further explanation. The platform is not removing his channel, but under the suspension, Trump is blocked from uploading new videos for at least 7 days. YouTube is also disabling comments on his videos indefinitely. Facebook and its subsidiary Instagram have also suspended Trump's accounts, while Twitter and Snapchat have permanently banned him. Critics call the moves a troubling encroachment on freedom of speech. Reporting for World, I'm Paul Butler.
Meantime, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says his city is terminating all contracts with President Trump's business enterprise.
It's just really clear. This president has committed an unlawful act. He has disgraced himself. He will no longer profit from his relationship with New York City. We will not allow it.
De Blasio said the Trump Organization earns about $17 million a year in profits from its contracts. It runs 2 ice skating rinks and a carousel in Central Park, as well as a golf course in the Bronx. The mayor said the city can legally terminate a contract if the leadership of a company is engaged in criminal activity. And de Blasio said, quoting here, inciting an insurrection against the United States government clearly constitutes criminal activity. A Trump Organization spokesperson responded, saying this is nothing more than political discrimination, an attempt to infringe on the First Amendment, and we plan to fight vigorously. Coronavirus deaths in the United States have set another single-day record. World's Kristen Flavin has that story.
More than 4,300 died in the United States Tuesday from the illness, with Arizona and California among the hardest hit states. More than 380,000 Americans have died during the pandemic, a total that is now closing in fast on the U.S. death toll from World War II. Just over 400,000 Americans died in the war. Deaths have been rising sharply in the past 2.5 months, and the country is in the most lethal phase of the outbreak yet, even as the vaccine is rolled out. New cases are running at nearly 250,000 per day on average. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Canada's most crowded province has ordered a new lockdown as coronavirus cases surge. Ontario Premier Doug Ford announced the new stay-at-home order, which takes effect today. The order does grant exceptions for essential workers and activities like seeking health care and grocery shopping, but police will enforce violations. Meantime, across the Atlantic, British Health Secretary Matt Hancock said his country's lockdown will stay in place as long as necessary, but he added that he is optimistic.
We're on track to deliver the vaccination program to the four groups who are most vulnerable to COVID by the 15th of February. That's really good news.
The British government imposed restrictions around the first of the year in hopes of lifting them in mid-February. But Hancock said the government will not ease the lockdown before delivering vaccines to the highest priority groups. The UK is the epicenter of a new, more contagious variant of the coronavirus. Prosecutors in Michigan Wednesday charged former Republican Governor Rick Snyder with two counts of willful neglect of duty in connection with the Flint water crisis. The charges follow a years-long investigation into lead-contaminated water in the Flint water system, which was blamed for a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. The charges, shown in an online court record, are misdemeanors punishable by up to a year in jail. New charges are also expected against several other former state officials. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, a common-sense ruling on transgenderism in the UK. Plus, Cal Thomas offers a suggestion for building a better future. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the 14th of January, 2021. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown. First up, gender dysphoria. Now, before we go any further, this is a story that might not be appropriate for younger listeners. So if you've got the kids around, you might want to hit pause and come back later.
Last month, Great Britain's highest court handed down a ruling that limits access to puberty blockers for minors. The decision put the brakes on the headlong rush to treat gender dysphoria as a physical problem rather than a mental and emotional one. Child advocates hailed it as a victory for vulnerable teens who need protection, sometimes from themselves. World's Anna Johansson Brown reports.
When Kira Bell was 16, she wanted to be a boy. She struggled with depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts. She thought she'd been born in the wrong body, so she went to London's Tavistock Center. It runs the country's only gender identity development clinic. There, she got puberty blockers, then cross-sex hormones, like testosterone, then a double mastectomy, all so she could live as a man. Here she is in a 2020 interview with the BBC.
You know, years ago when I went to the clinic, it felt like, you know, it was saving me from, you know, suicidal ideation and just depression in general. And, you know, at the time, I felt like it relieved all of those mental health conditions that I was, you know, struggling alongside, you know, gender dysphoria.
But her mental health struggles persisted, and Belle began to regret making such radical, life-changing decisions as a teen. She wanted to be a girl again. Eventually, Belle sued the gender clinic, saying she was rushed into treatment without enough counseling and therapy. She says no one challenged her ideas or offered a different way of thinking.
I should have been, you know, told to wait and not affirmed in my gender identity I was claiming to have.
In December, Belle won her case. The UK's highest court ruled that minors under the age of 16 should not be given puberty blockers without a court order. The ruling emphasized the experimental nature of the drugs, the lack of evidence showing they help improve mental health, or that they're even safe and without serious side effects. Dr. Andre Van Maal is a family practitioner in California. He says the court is exactly right.
Well, it's hardly a hormonally neutral thing you're doing to the person, and that the consequences of treatment are highly complex and potentially lifelong and life-changing in the most fundamental way imaginable.
Puberty blockers are just what they sound like. As long as the patient gets regular injections, the drugs stop puberty from happening. Advocates say it's a pause button that allows children extra time to decide what gender they really want to be. They insist the effects are fully reversible. But Dr. Van Maal points out that's not a sure thing. After all, during puberty, there's a lot going on. Major changes in organs and musculature.
Puberty is the time of the greatest increase in bone density a person has in their life. So if you block that, that's a problem. You're asking for premature osteopenia and osteoporosis.
The brain also develops rapidly during puberty.
Hindering of brain development milestones, you know, can you get those back later? We don't know.
Dr. Van Maal says it just isn't possible for a young person to make an informed choice on something like this because they cannot grasp the scope and implications of the decision. Ryan Anderson is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
When you think about the things that are really, really meaningful to adults when it comes to family life and their fertility and their ability to have children and to nurse children, that to kids aren't even on the radar screen.
Parents are in an especially tough spot.
My name is Gigi LaRue, and I am using a pseudonym. I work with Our Duty USA, which is a group of parents whose children have become convinced that they're born in the wrong body.
LaRue uses a pseudonym to protect her young daughter, who struggles with gender dysphoria.
She sort of got the idea from someone else, and, you know, it made sense to her because she feels uncomfortable, but it's a very alluring concept to believe that any discomfort you have in your body can be fixed with surgery and drugs.
LaRue says she's one of the most liberal people on the planet, but she doesn't think kids should be making gender decisions so young.
And little kids are, who still believe in the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus, are grasping these ideas and applying them to themselves and being encouraged by parents and the community to be, you know, be your authentic self. Instead of being allowed to explore tutus and, you know, dolls as a boy, they're being told that they're really a girl, or vice versa.
Without getting to the root problems, puberty blockers and hormones and surgery won't fix anything.
A lot of them detransition. There's a lot of kids who have changed their minds because they weren't ready, and it didn't solve it, and they did make a decision too early. And so I think that that's trying to sort of be hush-hushed because nobody wants to admit that this doesn't always work.
Instead of rushing to intervention and changing the body, Dr. Van Maal recommends trying to understand why children feel this way.
You're going to find underlying issues, both in the child and the family. And those can be addressed. You know, interventions can happen to help those, which will also improve the situation.
Gigi LaRue wants more people to speak up.
It's really difficult to find somebody who will even talk about it with you because everyone's afraid. We're not allowed to talk about it. We're not allowed to publicly disagree with it because you're immediately labeled as phobic or somehow anti, which is not the case. I just don't believe children should be medicalized.
She doesn't agree with conservatives on much of anything, but she says advocates for puberty blockers are practicing bad medicine, and that should unite people on both sides of the aisle. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, persecution.
Every year, persecution watchdog Open Doors releases a list of the places where it's most difficult for Christians to practice their faith. This year's list includes some familiar names and reveals some disturbing new trends. World's Lee Jones reports.
The global pandemic has disrupted life for just about everyone around the world. But for Christians, that disruption has been especially painful.
Governments and extremists are using COVID-19 as a way to justify an increase in the persecution of Christians.
David Curry is CEO of Open Doors. He says in some places, like India, Christians who have lost their jobs during lockdowns can't get access to government aid.
In many cases, those village leaders will not distribute food to Christians because they think they have either, in a religious sense, brought a curse upon themselves, or because they say, you're not part of our group, you're not part of our tribe.
In places like Somalia, Islamic militants are using the pandemic to stoke hatred and fear.
Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group within that country, has spread the word and is reporting that the coronavirus is the fault of Christians. It's this kind of misinformation in some communities that is driving some of this persecution.
But perhaps the most dangerous trend related to the pandemic involves an increase in government surveillance, starting with the place where the new coronavirus originated. Chris Messerol is a foreign policy expert with the Brookings Institution. He says that while public surveillance in China is nothing new, Beijing has now honed its ability to track people in private.
What's never been possible before, really, is a surveillance technology that enabled the regime to ban like private forms of religion, right? Even kind of the private, you know, messages and communications that people have, or what they say in their home, or banning and effectively enforcing the ability of religious communities to kind of meet in private, you know, maybe not in a public church, but in somebody's house. And on top of that, they've also got this incredible array of geolocation data, so that if you are trying to meet with certain folks in private, they can actually figure that out and begin to unwind some of those private religious communities too.
Messerol says when that's paired with existing systems that track online communication and public movements, the government can build a frightening level of detail about where people have been and what they've been doing.
It's a new technology that we haven't really seen before used in quite this way. And it's something that, you know, again, if we're concerned about religious freedom, we should really be taking it seriously.
Because what starts in China won't stay there. Rushan Abbas is a Uyghur American activist who advocates for China's persecuted Muslim minority group. She says Beijing's campaign against Uyghur Muslims is part of a pilot program.
China's already exporting this to other parts of the world, to other countries. So if we don't stop what the Chinese government is doing to the Uyghurs right now, just to look at the Uyghur people today and imagine the future, the tomorrow, for the world.
David Curry says that while the United States is in the midst of its own debate about online privacy and censorship, it's nowhere near China in terms of surveillance.
I also think, though, that if it helps you to imagine what it might be like within America, let that motivate you to care deeply about what's happening to people of faith, Christians around the world, wherever they may be. Whatever pressure or intolerance you sense or you feel, I can promise you it's 1,000 times worse in every country on the world watch list.
The top 10 countries on this year's list are North Korea, Afghanistan, Somalia, Libya, Pakistan, Eritrea, Yemen, Iran, Nigeria, and India. Reporting for World, I'm Lee Jones.
Well, they say necessity is the mother of invention, and coronavirus lockdowns have proven that old adage to be very true. The owner of a bed and breakfast in northern Michigan says business suffered when virus restrictions forced him to shut down the dining room.
I knew at the end of summer the writing was on the wall and we had to come up with something.
So that's when Graham Lease got creative. He installed 5 shanties on the property. Now, those are little shacks popular with ice fishermen. Leask is a Scottish transplant to the snowy lakefront region. He told WPBN,
"What's more northern Michigan than ice shanties? So we built them, and here we are."
And with the help of local artists, he turned them each into a charming private dining room. And they've been a big hit with customers, allowing him to bring 4 people back to work and even hire a new employee.
It's wonderful. I thank everybody for their support, keeping local people working.
It's the world and everything in it. Today is Thursday, January 14th. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Megan Basham. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, COVID-19 Silver Linings.
The coronavirus and the pandemic shook up everyone's life in one way or another. And many of those changes were painful and hard, but turns out some were for good. World's Sarah Schweinsberg has our story.
Violinist Gaga Wan has a new student. The little girl has the look of a deer in headlights. Her eyes stare straight ahead, wide and brown. Her legs are stiff.
So don't lock your knees.
Gaga Wan encourages her to relax and focus on the strings and her fingers.
Good. So holding a bow. So thumb, and then these two fingers are like here, and then pinky on the wrist.
Wan stands in front of her, her black bobbed hair pulled into a ponytail, arms wrapped in a bright gold sweater. She reaches out and repositions the violin and the bow in the student's arms. Wan reminds her to start beats on a down bow, then the up bow. The young girl gingerly scratches the strings of her violin.
So down bow first.
Wan shows the student how to move the bow with confidence. On a second try, the student's violin starts to sing. It's one of the many small victories that makes teaching music so fun. Yeah, an experience Gaga Wan didn't plan on having.
I don't usually live here. My parents live here, but I usually live in San Francisco.
Here is Fort Dodge, Iowa. Wan's family left South Korea for the United States when she was 12 years old. They first settled in Michigan. The family didn't speak English, and they didn't have much money.
When you first move into, like, in a different country, you know, it's you always have a hard time, like, trying to survive. And
Wan had started to learn the violin and piano in South Korea. In America, her mother told her they could no longer afford lessons. A year later, she took up her instruments again, until her mother got sick, and she had to quit once more. That's when a kind teacher stepped in.
I just, like, happened to, like, saw my teacher on the street, and then my teacher was like, oh, Gaga, why are you not showing up in lesson? But I couldn't really speak English very well, so I was just, like, crying. I just, like, told my teacher that my mom's not well, and he offered me free lessons for a year or 2 years, I think.
With the help of her teacher, Gaga Wan earned a scholarship to a music boarding school, then to the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, then to the Yale School of Music. All along the way, teachers taught her, pushed her, critiqued her, encouraged her. Wan can remember the way each one affected her playing and her life.
I think it's really important to have, like, a really, really good relationship with a teacher. Yeah, then it will, like, spark.
After Yale, Wan moved back to San Francisco. There, she auditioned for parts in prestigious orchestras. She toured Japan and Italy and China, playing in front of large audiences. Wan loved playing the violin. She loved her music community. By most professional violin standards, she'd arrived. But life was still a rat race.
I thought, like, if I reach this, then, like, I thought I'll be happy, I'll be done. But then there, like, if you go up there, there's more. It's just, like, never ending.
Then the coronavirus came to San Francisco. It quickly shut down the city and its music scene.
I was suffering so much during pandemic in San Francisco.
After nearly 8 weeks of lockdown, Gaga Wan began asking herself why she was paying to live in a city where she couldn't work. So she decided to return to the small city of Fort Dodge, Iowa, where her parents run a South Korean restaurant.
So coming home was kind of more relief.
She tried to work in the restaurant, but she got in the way more than she helped.
Like, I was so, like, useless.
Then a music teacher heard she was back in town. She asked Wan to take on some students of her own. So Wan began teaching violin and piano. Wan gives lessons at an old piano. A young boy with a blonde buzz cut calls out the names of notes. Today, another small victory. Gaga Wan can tell he practiced this week. He's usually quite creative with his excuses.
Good. So you actually practiced this time. Good job. High five. Good job.
Wan says when she came back to Iowa, she thought she'd return to San Francisco as soon as possible. But now, she plans to stick around. So many teachers poured into her life. Now, it's her turn.
I'm actually glad I get to teach here, and I am supporting all my students and, you know, the community. I also learned a lot of things when I did the teaching.
And she's enjoying the peace her new town offers, and the time with her parents. Things she never knew she needed, until COVID opened her eyes.
I do miss a lot, and I miss performing in the stage. But I think staying with my parents, it also kind of helped me stay calm more, rather than only thinking about the future. I think I'm more focused on now.
Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Coming up next, a preview of Listening In. This week, a conversation with conservative author Rod Dreher. Now, Dreher believes a soft totalitarianism is taking hold in America. In this excerpt of their conversation, host Warren Smith asks him to define terms.
Rod, you differentiate between authoritarianism, totalitarianism, and a soft totalitarianism. Can you say more about these three words and the distinctions between them?
Sure, yeah, this is important to get clear. Authoritarianism is a form of government that you have when all the political power is concentrated in one leader or one party. Totalitarianism is an extreme form of authoritarianism, and that's when the same political power is concentrated, but every aspect of life is taken to be political, where they really want to control reality. Well, I believe that what Solzhenitsyn and the communist dissidents lived under was hard totalitarianism. It was a totalitarianism characterized by a police state, by the gulags, by prisons for political dissidents, by secret police and torture. We don't have that. We have rather a softer form of totalitarianism where not only the state, but major institutions like Google, Amazon, like universities, like media and others are manufacturing consent and making it impossible for people who don't go along with their official lies, for example, usually with identity politics. They're making it impossible for people who refuse to go along with that to work and to be part of the public square. They're doing this not with the use of secret police or these hard methods, but rather by soft methods like, it doesn't seem very soft if you're canceled, but that's what I'm talking about. By cancel culture, by credentialism, I think it's going to be difficult, for example, for Christians to practice law or get into medicine if they don't affirm some things that Christians can't affirm. And finally, I call it soft because it's being done for the sake of therapy. These totalitarians say that we're doing it just to make a safer space for marginalized identities, that sort of thing. It makes it no less totalitarian, Warren, that they're doing it for soft reasons, using softer methods.
That's Rod Dreher talking to Warren Smith. To hear their complete conversation, look for Listening In tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts. Today is Thursday, January 14th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Cal Thomas now on why political revenge won't bring the healing our country so desperately needs.
You've heard the saying, revenge is a dish best served cold. That means it's better to deliver retribution for a perceived or actual injustice after time has passed so it can be done dispassionately. But sometimes it's better not to serve that dish at all. Dispassion is in retreat in Washington. Instead of serving revenge cold, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and many other Democrats are turning up the heat. Some conservatives I hear from believe Democrats are trying to impeach President Trump for a second time and deny him the right to ever hold office again because they fear his policy successes and the 74 million people who voted for him. That's more than revenge. It's vindictive. If Pelosi and her fellow Democrats proceed with their threats, it will only further divide the country, deepen conspiracy theories, possibly leading to more violence, and hinder the confirmation of Joe Biden's nominees for critical offices. It could also embolden our enemies. We have a better model for dealing with a president many feel has disgraced himself and the office of the presidency. It's what Gerald Ford did for former President Richard Nixon following his resignation over the Watergate affair. On September 8, 1974, Ford pardoned Nixon. He noted a Senate trial would take up to a year, and in the meantime, the tranquility to which this nation has been restored by the events of recent weeks, meaning Nixon's resignation, could be irreparably lost by the prospects of bringing to trial a former president of the United States. Ford continued in his pardon announcement. The prospects of such a trial will cause prolonged and divisive debate over the propriety of exposing to further punishment and degradation a man who has already paid the unprecedented penalty of relinquishing the highest office of the United States. True, President Trump's situation is different. He hasn't resigned or suffered from his actions, real or alleged. In fact, he's categorically denied responsibility, but the principle remains the same. This vindictiveness has spread to members of the White House staff and even to Trump supporters in Congress. There have been calls, including from Forbes magazine, to deny them future employment as punishment for their association with Trump. This is reminiscent of the Hollywood blacklist, the Red Scare, and the McCarthy era. Where are the principled people who courageously stood up against those smears? If they don't stand up again now, they risk possible future harm to themselves and to the country. The best policy now is to allow Trump to leave office and let the justice system work. If he's committed crimes, let the courts deal with them. Congress should focus on building a better future rather than dwelling on a bitter past. Vindictiveness will only turn him into a martyr in the minds of his supporters. That, too, would be bad for the country. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, Trevin Wax joins us for Culture Friday. We'll talk about the push to censor conservative voices online. And I'll review the latest Tom Hanks movie. That and more tomorrow. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but whoever takes crooked paths will be found out. Go now in grace and peace.